Yeah, it, now, some of the areas that Larry is touching on and developing a little more here, I'll be addressing tomorrow evening. And I can hardly wait to do that, and with a spirit of humility and confidence that it will be helpful to many of you. And it will represent a clarification and a qualification of some of the things that you've heard, no doubt, as you might understand. I'm going to do two things in my last 15 minutes. And one is just to briefly touch on the 1 Corinthians 13 passage that Larry developed in his first presentation. It's very interesting. Looking at 1 Corinthians 13 and like verse 9, now we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect is come, etc., then these things will be done away. The partial will be done away with. Verse 11, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things, for now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. When I read it, you know, one of the principles for reading the Bible and principles of Bible study is that we should simply take the Bible as it reads. It's plain reading unless there's something indicating in the context in the verse itself that it should be read otherwise. Figure of speech, parable, hyperbole, you know, there are different things that will be indicated when something is not to be taken literally but seen as indicating something else. There's nothing in this passage that gives me the liberty to take verse 12, and then we see in the mirror dimly, but then face to face, and lift that away from the second coming. You know, this language you see is second coming language. We will see Jesus coming. You know, Revelation chapter, what is it, chapter, chapter 1 and verse 8 or 9, it says, every eye shall see him, even those who pierced Jesus are going to see him when he comes a second time. They're going to see his face. They're going to see his wounds. You know, and so we have that in verse 7. Behold, he's coming with clouds. Every eye will see him. Will his face be veiled then? This is when we will see God in the person of Jesus Christ face to face. And they also who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. The lost, you see, will see Jesus face to face. You know, when you look at the commentators, you know, the scholars, and you know, we start first with the Bible, but then we also look at to see what commentators when they have the expertise in terms of the original language and so forth, what they say about various verses. And when I look at those, I would challenge you, if you could go through, have some access to many different Bible commentaries on this passage, what you will find is what I found here. Verses 8 and 9, I'm just looking at the commentary, love never ends, literally never collapses, it is eternal by nature. Unlike the gifts which are designed for the present life, prophecy and tongues, etc., they will be unnecessary in the immediate presence of God, when we see him face to face. The language is second coming language. A little bit over in this commentary, and it's the new Bible commentary revised. And the scholars are conservative scholars, Donald Guthrie and et cetera, D.J. Wiseman. These are well known in large conservative circles of Christianity and education, seminaries and so forth. But the comment on 2 Corinthians 12 here, I just want to read that. But then, the but then word there, that is, in the next life we shall see face to face, etc. So that's all I'm going to say about that. And it won't be satisfactory to some of you, but I wanted to at least address that. Now, now we have one other item. Looking at moving from the face-to-face in terms of that being the second coming language. You know, the Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 17 and 18, he expressed some concerns for a certain kind of thinking. And here it is. I'm going to read it first. The Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy 2:17, he says, "And their message," I'm in the middle of the verse, I think, where it starts, "and their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth, saying that the resurrection is already past." I should just read on. "Saying that the resurrection is already past, and they overthrow the faith of some." Also, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 12 through 19, speaks along these lines. "Apparently, there were some at Corinth who denied the possibility of a bodily resurrection of the dead." Looking at that in verses 13 through 19. And Paul demonstrates the destructive nature of such a denial and shows how such a belief is incompatible with the proven fact that Jesus had been raised. Now, in the 70 AD theory, isn't there some resurrection that took place? I'll just leave that for maybe someone to tell me afterwards. Isn't there a concept of resurrection? I understand Jesus, when he came forth from the grave in the spring of 31 AD. Yes, there were those bodies of the saints who were sleeping who rose with him on the first day of the week. But were there other resurrections that in the Church of Christ thinking that took place before 70 AD? I don't know what your thinking is on that. But there's a concept that's called realized eschatology. You have this word eschaton, that's the Greek word eschaton, meaning end things. And so thus eschatology, the study of end time things and prophecies. And these are words that scholars use to encapsulate the teaching that essentially all prophecy culminated with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In this belief, Matthew 24 has been largely fulfilled. Matthew 24, verse 15. And we'll touch on that. We may touch on that tomorrow. It gets into the question of how the word world is used, the Greek words for world. Is it gay or G? And then cosmos and one more. Ecumene. These are three words that are used to describe earth, world, land. But I may find a little place where I can address that. They're actually very, very interchangeable. They're very interchangeable. As I understand it, in the Church of Christ teaching, Matthew 24:15, coming back, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world," okay, "and then the end will come." That is a huge thing to try to wrap one's head around. That prophecy pertained just to the Mediterranean world, the Greco-Roman world of the apostles' time, and not the whole planet. There's a hint of the realized eschatology concern here. But it's the idea that Matthew 24 has been largely fulfilled, that Revelation has been 95% essentially fulfilled, that Nero fulfilled the prophecy as the beast in Revelation 13, in no literal 1,000 years, also known as the millennium, the amillennialist view. And this approach is what Bible scholars call preterism. Preterism of that meaning past. In contrast, futurism. So preterism, futurism. All things are mostly happen in the past. Revelation is larger than the past. These prophecies are larger than the past, as the preterist view. And then the futurist view, as you will know from the Baptists and Assemblies of God and so forth, these are largely in the future. But then in the middle, you see, and this is where the Bible brings this out, Adventists take the position of being a historicism. And on that basis, you see, you simply have the Bible is, the prophecies of the Bible are ongoing and they're fulfilling. And that's why we can understand the signs of the times in terms of where we are here and now, relative to the past and the present, in terms of what is happening. These two teachings, preterism, is mostly in the past, and futurism is mostly in the past. These ideas, you see, this way of viewing the prophecies was something that originated in what's called the Counter-Reformation. The Counter-Reformation. So in the late 1500s, you see, in 1600s, you see the first Protestants, you see, they saw and understood quite well and correctly that the emergence of the papacy, that's the office of the Pope, that this position and this claim, you see, played into the fulfilling of the prophecies regarding Antichrist. The Antichrist. You know, anti does not mean against. It does not mean against. It never means against in the Greek, and it's used in the New Testament. It never means against. It means in place of Christ, on Christ's behalf. He is equivalent. It's an inside job. I have a lot more information here than I can effectively give you, but I'm going to give you a few passages that demonstrate historicism, that we should read the Bible, you see, as ongoing. The prophecies of Daniel and the Revelation, they are ongoing in their fulfilling, you see, and that we may enter into the understanding of where we are in the stream of time. John chapter 16, 14 and 13, Gospel of John chapter 16. Watch, these are the words of Jesus. And we're looking at verses 4 and 16. Okay, John 16, 4. But these things I have told you, Jesus is speaking, that when the time comes, you may remember that I told you of them. And these things I did not say to you at the beginning because I was with you. All right, do you see? So prophecies are made, I tell you before they happen. And then as they unfold and become reality or history, you see, the faith of the apostles is affirmed and they receive comfort and guidance, you see, going forward and having wisdom to know what to do in the present as the prophecies unfold and become a reality on the ground. Okay, here's another one, Amos 3:7, Old Testament. Surely the Lord God does nothing without revealing his secrets unto his servants, the prophets. Surely the Lord God does nothing without telling his servants, the prophets. That is, he gives them history in advance, the prophecy. Now, that's another. I did a rough paraphrase of that. Pardon me. Isaiah chapter 50, that is chapter 46. All right, chapter 46. And here we go. And we're looking at verses 9 through 11. And it says, remember the former things of old, Isaiah 46, what? 9. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me. What? Verse 10. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, I will do all my pleasure, etc. And down in the middle of verse 11, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will also do it. And then Revelation 1:19, all the way back to the end of the Bible, 1:19, watch this. This is amazing for us as I read this. I enjoy this so much. Because you see, it gives us a way to approach the book of Revelation. and here we are, chapter 1 and verse 19. Jesus is speaking. He says in verse 17, don't be afraid, I'm the first and the last. I am he who lives, was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of Hades and death. Verse 19. Write the things which you have seen. That's the past. And the things which are. Alright, that's the present. And the things which are to take place after this. The past, the present, the future. This is the essence of historicism. And 40 seconds, here we go. Listen to this. Seventh-day Adventists really are essentially, we stand alone as being historicists. The first Protestants, all historical scholars, biblical scholars, so forth, church history people will tell you that this was the only approach to prophecy for many, many centuries. Looking at those texts that we just wrote, keep those in mind. But listen to this. Seventh-day Adventists essentially stand alone as historicists. They believe that the book of Revelation describes in its visions the unfolding of all history, from the time when John received the apocalypse to the end of the age, the second coming. The seals, the trumpets, the vials, even the letters to the seven churches describe in progressive stages the vicissitudes of the Church of God as it struggles against human and demonic forces in its pilgrimage towards the city of God. I didn't create those words, but I love them. They capture the, in a very powerful way, the historicist prophetic way of viewing. And we think we know the scriptures indeed bring that to light. More to say, but looks like we're done for the evening. And God bless.